The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next hour I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsugginsurance.com. That's gsugginsurance.com. Or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition of Time Magazine is dated December 27, 2021. January 3, 2022. It is a double issue. It has the typical red border on the cover with a very narrow white inner border. It's Person of the Year issue, and Time is superimposed upon a dark background in white to gray white capital large print lettering. Elon Musk is the headline, Person of the Year, and the cover features his portrait. He's looking into the camera at an angle. We see only his face, his head, and his collar. He has greenish-brown eyes. He has brownish hair combed back from his face. He has a stubble of a beard in blondish brown or brownish blonde, and he looks neither happy nor sad, but rather serious and intent. Again, Elon Musk was named Time's Person of the Year for the year 2021. Also included in this edition of Time are other topics, including Heroes of the Year, Entertainer of the Year, TV Shows of the Year, and we will be looking at those next. Within the Heroes of the Year category, the miracle workers. In giving the world a weapon against COVID-19, these scientists built a defense against challenges yet to come. This is by Alice Park and Jamie Ducharme. Photographs by Mattia Balsamini for Time. And indeed, this title page has a light blue background, lighter in tint than Carolina blue. And in front of this background, standing also looking quite seriously, are two individuals, a woman and a man. Both are wearing lab coats. We see only the heads and shoulders. She has short cropped grayish and darkish hair, blue eyes, glasses. She's wearing a top that includes a dark colored, either black or navy, turtleneck, over which she wears a white lab coat with the insignia BioNTech on one of the pockets. Just to her side and a little bit behind her is a man, mostly bald, but with some dark and graying hair. He's looking with brownish, greenish, gray eyes upward into the camera, wearing a white shirt, blue striped tie, and again, a white lab coat. Now turning the page into the text. I believe they give the identity of these persons, including two on the next page, also a woman and a man, also wearing white lab coats over other dressier attire. And the caption for these two photos, which is like half of a double spread, from left, Kathleen Carrico, Drew Weissman, Kizimekia Corbett, and Barney Graham all played key roles in making COVID-19 vaccines a reality. So it's a quartet making up the title page and second page photos. No one knows for sure where the virus came from. It could have been the murky depths of one of the hundreds of bat caves scattered across China. Carried inside a bat on a nightly sojourn, the virus may have jumped to another wild animal, perhaps one of those sold in the wet markets in the region. It is also possible SARS-CoV-2, the virus that causes COVID-19, slipped out of a lab at the Wuhan Institute of Virology, unbeknownst to the researchers studying bat-borne coronaviruses, who were perhaps unintentionally infected by the very thing they were trying to learn how to defend against. In either case, it had to ride in something. A virus, being just a bundle of genetic material wrapped in a bundle of proteins, needs the machinery of a living thing to reproduce. It is in the dark caverns of bodies that it continues to shift shape, finding new ways to spread and thrive. Only as the virus emerges from the shadows of these favored havens does it confront its most formidable foe, the scientists, quietly awaiting it. How they responded was less mysterious and certainly less unpredictable than the virus they targeted. Their medium was light, and the brightness of scientific truth, which they painstakingly pursued in brilliantly lit research labs and clean rooms, scrubbed of airborne particles, and produced brilliant results. About a month after the first cluster of patients appeared wheezing in a Wuhan hospital, the entire genome of the responsible coronavirus, 30,000 specific nucleotides, had been sorted, identified, and posted online. 2 weeks later, designs were already being keyed into machines to create a vaccine that would unlock a world that had not even locked down yet. Given that speed, it was easy to imagine a solution to the problem of SARS-CoV-2, and that's S-A-R-S in caps, CoV-2, was inevitable. After all, things we took to be miracles not long ago have become the stuff of everyday life, routine, apparently effortless. A miracle is as close at hand as your average smartphone, which has 100,000 times the computational power as the computer that took humankind to the moon. If in 2020, if the scientists in China were able to map the genetic structure of a novel virus in a few days, that sounded, well, about right. Later, as countries went into lockdown, we continued to assume progress, to regard vaccines as our due. Except there was nothing inevitable about them. The vaccines that first arrested the spread of COVID-19, and COVID again is in caps, COVID-19, and that will almost surely be adjusted to thwart the Omicron variant and future mutations, were never a foregone conclusion, far from it. They were, after all, produced by human beings, subject to the vagaries of systems and doubt. There were times in their careers when, deep in the work that would ultimately rescue humanity, Kismekia Corbett, Barney Graham, Catalin Carrico, and Drew Weissman felt as though the problems they faced were ones they alone cared about solving. But exposing the inner workings of how viruses survive and thrive is what made the COVID-19 vaccines possible. The four were hardly alone in those efforts. Scientists around the world have produced COVID-19 vaccines using a variety of platforms and technologies. Many, like the shots from Oxford AstraZeneca and Johnson & Johnson Janssen, came from more established methods, modified with impressive speed to fight a new virus. Still, Corbett, Graham, Carrico, and Weissman achieved a breakthrough of singular importance, introducing an innovative and highly effective vaccine platform based on mRNA, M in lowercase, RNA, uppercase. that will impact our health and well-being far beyond this pandemic. Progress flows from the gradual accretion of knowledge. In the case of the COVID-19 vaccines, it started with the initially painstaking process of decoding the genomes of all living things. Then, folded in the development of sequencing machines that reduce that genetic reading time to hours, and finally weaved in the insights, put it in a fat bubble that seemed to come in brilliant flashes, but were actually the result of wisdom developed over decades, working on how to manipulate a finicky genetic material called mRNA. What drives it all might, in less divisive times, seem too obvious to mention, fealty to facts. It is the basis of the scientific method and the structure of our world. Without trust in objective reality, the lights don't turn on. The computer doesn't boot up. The streets stay empty. We have turned a disease that has been a once-in-a-generation fatal pandemic that has claimed more than 780,000 lives in America into what is, for the most part, a vaccine-preventable disease, says Dr. Leanna Wen, professor of health policy and management at George Washington University. That is the difference the vaccine has made. For those of us lucky enough to live in wealthy countries with access to these top-shelf vaccines, it's made all the difference. The miracle workers behind the COVID-19 vaccines are the time heroes of the year, not only because they gave the world a defense against a pathogen, but also because the manner of that astonishing achievement guards more than our health. They channeled their ambitions to the common good, talked to one another, and trusted in facts. Katalin, and that is spelled K-A-T-A-L-I-N, Kariko, K-A-R-I-K-O, grew up the daughter of a butcher in a small town in Hungary, living under communist rule in the 1950s and 60s. The family had electricity, but not running water or a refrigerator. Watching her father at his job, the young Kariko became fascinated with figuring out how living things work. That took her to undergraduate studies in biology at the University of Szeged, where she first learned about RNA. It would become her obsession through her biochemistry PhD studies, postgraduate work, and really the rest of her life. If DNA makes up the letters of life, RNA creates the words and ultimately the sentences. Indeed, RNA, and specifically messenger RNA, or mRNA, instructs the body how to make all the proteins, enzymes, receptors, and other molecules that enable living things to function. As a PhD student, Kariko grew convinced that mRNA, modified in the right way, could be used to turn the body into its own drug-making factory and churn out tailored, precision compounds to treat any disease caused by a lack of a certain protein, which could be an enzyme or a hormone. The challenge with mRNA is that it's notoriously unstable. Inject it into the human body and it gets chewed up before it can serve its purpose. It's also difficult to work with since it needs to be stored at extremely low temperatures to remain intact. After a few years of frustrating work at the Biological Research Center at Szeged, with no success in corralling mRNA, Kariko lost funding to her lab. To continue her work, in 1985, She found a position at Temple University in Philadelphia, but faced a new obstacle. To discourage defection, the Hungarian government limited citizens to taking only $50 with them when they left the country. Karikal and her husband sold their car for $1,200 and sewed the cash inside their two-year-old daughter Susan's teddy bear. Karikal moved to the University of Pennsylvania in 1989. Few others at Penn or elsewhere were pursuing mRNA at the time because its payoff seemed uncertain. But Karikal persevered, envisioning a bonanza of new treatments for heart disease, stroke, and other conditions. She worked late nights and early mornings at her Penn lab and wrote at least one new grant application every month, only to get turned down again and again. "I think I was rejected at least 24 times," she says, "but I kept pushing because every time I wanted to understand why they rejected it and how I could improve." After 6 years, her supervisors at Penn grew weary of a lack of results and demoted her, cutting off her research funding and control of a lab. Undeterred, she moved to the neurosurgery department for a salary and lab space to continue her research. Things finally changed for Karikal in 1997 thanks to a casual office conversation by the copy machine. An immunologist and physician named Drew Weissman had just joined Penn to start a lab focused on developing a vaccine against HIV and other diseases. He and Karikal shared a habit of photocopying articles out of recent scientific journals from the research library. By the machine, they discussed their respective approaches to vaccine development. Karikal tried to convince Weissman of the still unappreciated merits of the synthetic RNA she was making. "I'm open to anything," says Weissman, and so he decided to give it a shot. Karikal's problem was she had not found a way to tamp down RNA's tendency to trigger the immune system's inflammatory response, which destroyed the RNA. Over the next decade, Karikal and Weissman combined efforts and eventually made a breakthrough, changing a specific mRNA building block help the molecule evade the immune system. Building on that, Weissman figured out that encasing the mRNA in a fat bubble protected the precious genetic code when it was introduced to the body of a living thing, while at the same time triggering the immune system to target it, which is what a vaccine needs to do. After that, their research sped up rapidly for disease after disease, more than 20 in all, including norovirus, influenza, HIV, hepatitis, and Zika, Z-I-K-A. The mRNA-based vaccines the duo developed during the 2000s were nearly 100% effective in protecting lab animals from getting infected and sick. The beauty of the platform lay in its flexibility. Influenza vaccines, for example, take months to develop because most require growing the virus in chicken eggs. An mRNA vaccine requires only a readout of a virus's genetic sequence. Scientists can take that code, pick out the relevant parts of the genome, build the corresponding mRNA with chemical compounds, pop it into the fat bubble, and presto, a new vaccine is born. In 2005, Karikal and Weissman reported their findings in what they thought would be a landmark paper in the journal Immunity, then waited for the accolades to flood in. "I told Kati the night before the paper was published, 'Tomorrow our phones are going to ring off the hook,' says Weissman." No one called. It would take another 15 years and the emergence of the devastating SARS-CoV-2 virus before the global science community would finally grasp the importance of their discoveries. In the meantime, some scientists were gradually starting to build the case for the promise of mRNA, including Ugur Sahin and Özlem Türeci, co-founders of a German company called BioNTech. In 2013, Carrico joined the company to head its mRNA program, focused at the time on cancer vaccines. In January 2020, Chinese researchers published the genetic sequence of the new coronavirus causing COVID-19. BioNTech quickly pivoted toward working on a vaccine for the novel coronavirus, eventually partnering with pharmaceutical giant Pfizer, P-F-I-Z-E-R. By then, the groundbreaking nature of the technology Carrico and Weissman had pioneered finally had the attention of scientists worldwide, who realized that the plug-and-play model meant potentially life-saving shots could be developed, and more important, delivered in record time. The duo had created the perfect vehicle for targeting any virus or pathogen, but making a truly effective vaccine, one that could also efficiently stir a powerful immune response inside the body, would require another step. The faint drawl and easygoing nature of Kansas native Dr. Barney Graham can hide an intensity of devotion and singularity of purpose, qualities that Dr. Anthony Fauci back in 1997 felt made Graham the perfect deputy director of the newly created Vaccine Research Center, VRC, of the U.S. National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. Here's a photo of Graham, not in a lab, but at his desk, with a window nearby, a lamp on, lots of knickknacks and books and papers and a coffee mug and photos and file folders and posters on the wall and a hutch on a desk that is L-shaped and put in the corner, and he's seated at his desk chair wearing blue jeans and a white shirt rolled up to the elbows. Vaccines appeal to Graham's MacGyver tendencies. As a child, he loved to troubleshoot broken-down equipment on the family farm. In the intervening years, those problem-solving interests migrated to HIV and respiratory syncytial, S-Y-N-C-Y-T-I-A-L, syncytial, I'm saying, maybe wrongly, for RSV, a cold-like contagion, when a new target, SARS-CoV-2, emerged. Over the decades leading to the pandemic, one approach in particular had captured his scientific curiosity, structure-based design. Essentially, constructing a vaccine based on the shape of the virus's proteins. This sounds intuitive enough, but at the time was not technologically feasible. It would take Graham 25 years to solve that problem. It turns out the configuration that a key RSV protein takes on just before it fuses with a healthy cell looks drastically different from the form it takes after infection. The latter was where most vaccine efforts had been focused up to that point, in part because it is only in that pre-fusion shape for a very short time as it reconfigures itself constantly to evade the most potent antibodies. But a more effective vaccine would target the virus before it attached. By 2012, Graham and a postdoctoral fellow had figured out a way to stabilize that ephemeral formation long enough to attract the right immune cells. That revelation would turn out to be foundational, because other viruses also adopt a similar pre-fusion form. They're on many of the envelope proteins that we study, like HIV, influenza, paramyxoviruses, and Ebola, he says, and they're also on coronaviruses. In 2014, to put the discoveries of Graham's team to the test, the VRC began collaborating with Moderna, a small biotech company based in Massachusetts. Like BioNTech, Moderna was working on making mRNA vaccines a reality, though focused on infectious diseases instead of cancer. In July 2019, Graham and his team published early results showing a vaccine built on Moderna's mRNA platform and containing their modified RSV protein boosted the immune response in people by more than tenfold over previous RSV vaccines. In the meantime, Kismekia Corbett, a PhD graduate in microbiology and immunology from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, joined Graham's team and had begun work applying what the group had learned about RSV to coronaviruses. By 2019, she and her colleagues had figured out how to design what's known as the spike protein, the part of the virus that attaches to the healthy cell, in such a way that the immune system could mount a maximal response. It was essentially advance work for the coming pandemic. When the first reports of the new coronavirus emerged from China, Graham and Corbett were confident the technique would work on it, says Corbett. All of that knowledge culminated to the point where we said, okay, we know how to design a really good vaccine because we've been doing this for 6 years. All they needed was the genetic code for SARS-CoV-2. Based on his success with freeze framing, the right viral structure of other viruses, Graham figured that stabilizing the SARS-CoV spike protein at its similar state just before infecting a cell would have the same immune activating effect in a vaccine. We had done it with a dozen other coronaviruses, and it worked every time, he says. I was anxious to get the sequence for SARS-CoV-2. January 9, 2020, about a year ago, he emailed the director of the Chinese Centers for Disease Control requesting the genomic data, then went to see Fauci. He came into the room on the 7th floor, says Fauci, and in his typical southern drawl said, I just need the sequence. I'm telling you, I think we can do this. January 10, Chinese scientists published the sequence of the new virus, and the team got to work. Dr. Graham and I had discussed exactly how we would maneuver in that moment, so once the sequence came out, we knew exactly what we would do, says Corbett. We knew where to make the mutations in the spike protein to stabilize it, and we knew the type of platform we would like to make the vaccine with, which was the mRNA platform with Moderna. So we really had a plan. Graham's insight to target the pre-fusion spike protein became the basis for several of the major vaccines being tested or used around the world now, including the ones from Pfizer, BioNTech, Moderna, Johnson & Johnson Janssen, Sanofi, and Novavax. Corbett predicts it will also help humanity defend against other viruses that may emerge in coming years. If we as scientists learn how to make a vaccine for a cousin in a viral family, and one of those cousins decides to make a pandemic, she says, then we will be ready, because we can apply the knowledge from one virus and vaccine to another in a plug-and-play way. After decades of largely unsung research, Corbett, Graham, Caracol, and Weissman didn't have to wait long to see the results of their work on COVID-19 vaccines. November 8, 2020, Fauci received a call from Pfizer CEO Albert Bourla. "Are you sitting down?" he asked Fauci, "because you're not going to believe the results. They're unbelievable. Over 90% efficacy." Graham's son and grandchildren were visiting when the news reached him. "We pretty much had a group hug and then I went back to work," he says. After those 10 months of working all the time and trying to get to an end point, just the relief to know that we had something that might make a difference was the thing that was most meaningful to me. Carico was celebrating her daughter's birthday with her husband when she got the call from Sahin, BioNTech CEO. He asked if she was alone, so she walked to another room, then celebrated in the same understated way that characterized her entire scientific career, with her favorite treat, a box of goobers. Weissman and Carico got their first doses of the vaccine they helped develop December 18, 2020. Just before Christmas, Graham and Corbett got their first shots. "Most scientists never get to see their product actually used," says Graham. "To watch the evening news and see the relief from healthcare providers who are getting immunized, to see people in the clinic at NIH being vaccinated and being so relieved and so grateful, those were special moments." The fastest any earlier vaccine had been developed was 4 years for mumps in the 1960s. The shots developed by Pfizer, BioNTech, and Moderna took less than 12 months. That made some skeptical. Could one trust a brand new technology engineered in record time to fight a brand new virus? That question, however, overlooks the years of work scientists had put into perfecting an mRNA platform. Without decades of basic research, those vaccines would not have been possible, says Dr. Stanley Plotkin, a veteran vaccinologist who invented the rubella vaccine. When the epidemic broke out, the technology was available. Corbett admits scientists themselves could have better communicated that fact. "Sometimes I regret the way we announced that we could have a vaccine," she says, "because it came without the understanding of all the work we had done before. While we did design a vaccine basically overnight and move quickly into clinical trials, there was so much confidence in the way we did that because we had been preparing for years. It was hardly the first miracle of science to defy belief." A year after the Apollo 11 lunar landing, 30% of Americans surveyed said they did not believe humans had actually walked on the moon. And that was long before social media, the rise of the anti-vax movement, and the many other recent crises of truth that have created barriers to the successful rollout of the vaccines. In the U.S., tens of millions of people refuse to get the shots that are available almost everywhere. Globally, vaccine hesitancy has combined with inequality and lack of access to create a disastrous state of affairs in poorer parts of the world. COVAX, C-O-V-A-X in caps, the multinational program designed to distribute vaccines to low-income countries, is only about a quarter of the way to its original goal of distributing 2 billion doses by the end of 2021. Some of that can be chalked up to wealthier countries hoarding doses, but there are other problems. In some parts of the world, when doses arrive, health workers must overcome significant logistical challenges to get them from airport tarmac to people in hard-to-reach places, and doubts about vaccine safety and efficacy have proved a global phenomenon. That mix of challenges has created severe vaccine inequality, such that only 30% of India is completely protected, and not even 10% of people in Africa have been fully vaccinated. As long as that is the case, the virus will continue to mutate, giving rise to new variants as it spreads almost unchecked. That does not mean the virus wins. The plug-and-play feature of the mRNA vaccines makes it possible to update them within months to target new variants, be it Omicron or whatever form the virus takes next. The virus moves fast, but scientists have created weapons just as nimble. Even the historically fast development of COVID-19 vaccines may seem slow in the future now that mRNA platforms have been pressure tested and fine-tuned. A renaissance in vaccinology is what University of Pittsburgh Center for Vaccine Research Director Paul Duprex calls the tools crafted by Carrico, Weissman, Graham, Corbett, and the many scientists who collaborated with them over the years. They represent a novel path out of this pandemic, but also a new approach to quelling future ones. Already, vaccine makers are testing mRNA-based vaccines against influenza, potentially making them more effective, safer, and easier to produce. Thanks to the scientists leading the groundbreaking development and elegant construction of these COVID-19 vaccines, we now have a list of near-infinite possibilities. The vaccines work with a magnificence that only highlights how far science has come and how far behind society remains in recognizing and accepting what is now possible. Our communications, our politics, our splintered cultures are still snarled in confusion and skepticism, keeping people from getting the shots. Through the harrowing first winter of COVID-19, scientists gifted humanity with the ultimate prize, a weapon to fight the pandemic. It's now up to humanity to return the favor. Alice Park and Jamie Ducharme wrote that article, with reporting by Leslie Dickstein and Julia Zorfin. 2021 Best of Culture heads this article, Best Albums by Andrew R. Chow and Katie Lang. They have 10 listed. Promises, Listening to Promises by Pharoah Sanders and Floating Points. It's like driving through an ever-changing coastal landscape as sheer cliffs, flowing rivers, and rolling fields of purples and reds emerge out of the haze. Organized around one recurring ethereal riff, the unlikely collaborative duo of Sanders, an 81-year-old Arkansan free jazz saxophonist, and Floating Points, a 35-year-old British electronic producer, build a topography of reverie and chaos with some help from the magisterial London Symphony Orchestra. It is a stunning nexus of jazz, classical, and ambient influences that transcends genre to create something wholly new. Vince Staples, number two, on his eponymous fourth studio album, Long Beach, California rapper Vince Staples fully leans into the elements that have garnered him a cult following in the indie rap scene: down-tempo beats, moody melodies, and dark, deadpan wit about the grim realities of the street. Produced entirely by his friend and hip-hop producer of the moment, Kenny Beats, this tightly curated 10-track LP offers the most intimate look yet at who the inscrutable Staples is, as both a man and an artist. 3. To hell with it. If you're searching for the sound of the future, look no further than Pink Pantheress's exhilarating debut mixtape for the digital age. The 20-year-old artist pulls from old-school house and garage samples fortified with doses of breakbeat to construct her dreamy, emotive dance tracks, bolstered by her silky, angelic vocals. The 10 songs clock in at just under 19 minutes, but this brevity highlights her dexterous ability to deliver a vibe in 2 minutes or less. Blue Weekend. Elegant, petulant, abrasive, foreboding, the third album from the English rock band Wolf Alice covers a lot of emotional and musical ground, and it does so fluidly and flawlessly. Lead singer Ellie Rausel sounds tremendous throughout, whether she's sweetly harmonizing with herself in tributes to California on the standout Delicious Things, or screaming with the feral energy of Courtney Love. Still Over It is number 5. Like any true diva of the R&B genre, Summer Walker's music is fueled by romantic melodrama. Her excellent second studio album is no exception. Inspired by the rumored infidelity of a former partner, London on the track, not only the father of her daughter but a producer on several of the album's songs, Walker uses Still Over It as both dialogue and catharsis. The result is a soulful, intoxicating breakup album, destined to become a contemporary R&B classic. With smooth-as-hell vocals and deliciously wry misandry, Heartbreak never sounded so good. 6 is the Marfa Tapes, M-A-R-F-A. While most country music coming out of Nashville these days wears a glossy sheen, this record from Miranda Lambert, Jack Ingram, and John Randall was recorded in the desert of Marfa, Texas, where you can hear beer cans crack open and planes fly overhead. But what the album lacks in production value, it more than makes up for in breathtaking triple harmonies, tender finger-picked guitar work, and an ineffable sense of communal joy. Together, the trio finds ecstasy in small things like homegrown tomatoes and deliverance after brutal heartbreak. 7. Donda, D-O-N-D-A. It would be easy to let the polarizing controversies of Kanye West overshadow the exhilarating thrills of his 10th studio album, but to do so would be to miss out on a glorious, if slightly messy, opus. The album, which rolled out after a series of highly publicized listening parties, finds Ye pondering his faith and mother, for whom the album is named, Donda, his impending divorce, and his family over a sprawling and ambitious 27 tracks. Though haters derided its length and contentious release, its joy lies within its huge roster of guest talent, from The Weeknd to Jay Electronica, and West's impressive ability to commandeer this wealth into a sonic experience both spiritual and sublime. The Hands of Time is 8. The percussionist, Weedy Brahman, Brahma, B-R-A-I-M-A, draws a link between West African drumming traditions and newer strains of Black American music, including hip-hop, funk, jazz, and fusion. On this astonishingly diverse yet cohesive album, while more famous luminaries like Trombone Shorty and Christian Scott Atunda Ajua show up for solos, Brahma's powerful djembe work remains at the forefront throughout. Navy's Reprise is number 9. The Brooklyn rapper and skateboarder Sage Elsesser, who goes by Navy Blue, raps with a cool patience, his lyrics spilling out not so much in couplets as amorphous word clouds. Over dusty soul samples, deft piano voicings, and whining saxophones, Elsesser raps of family, strife, and salvation, employing a flurry of homonyms and internal rhymes that will keep listeners finding new sleights of tongue upon every play. And finally, 10, Ho Tales. H-E-A-U-X is how it's spelled. I'm pronouncing it ho. Who knows? Jasmine Sullivan fully commits to her pleasure and ours with Ho Tales. Her fourth studio album, a paean to the triumphs and tribulations of sex and love, interspersed with spoken word interludes by a chorus of different women, the album is an ode to female desire, driven by Sullivan's sultry powerhouse vocals. Moving along with Time's 2021 Best of Culture Best Movies by Stephanie Zakarik, 10 of them. The Power of the Dog is number one. In 1920s Montana, a misanthropic rancher, Benedict Cumberbatch, and there's a big photo of Benedict Cumberbatch. It's at least one page, more like one and a third, just a headshot here in black and white. He's got a lot of wrinkles on his brow. He's got messy hair that is not really long. It's trimmed neatly, but there's a lot of it. Something of facial hair. It's a blurry photo. Cumberbatch plays a contemptuous rancher in The Power of the Dog. Okay, back to The Power of the Dog. Benedict Cumberbatch meets a reedy, dreamy teenager, Cody Smith McPhee, who arouses his contempt and more. Jane Campion's gorgeous, sinewy western, based on Thomas Savage's 1967 novel, is a movie as big as the open sky, but also one where human emotions are distinctly visible, as fine and sharp as a blade of grass. Number two, The Worst Person in the World, Danish-Norwegian director Joachim Trier's staggeringly tender comedy drama feels like a gift from the gods. On the road to figuring out who she is, Julie, Renata Rensfe, in a performance of marvelous, sturdy delicacy, falls in love first with one man and then another, only to realize she's lost more than ever. Trier guides this story to a joyous, bittersweet landing, a reminder that we're all works in progress, unfinished beings, whose only imperative is to turn toward the light. Number three, Summer of Soul, Amir Questlove Thompson's radiant documentary chronicles a star-studded free concert series that took place in a Harlem park during the summer of Woodstock, but received far less attention. The Harlem Cultural Festival drew huge crowds, but in the years since, this civil rights era celebration of pride and music had been largely forgotten, or perhaps more accurately, simply neglected, like jewels hidden in plain sight. The film showcases glorious performances from Mahalia Jackson, Stevie Wonder, and Nina Simone. At last, the world is ready to take notice. Number four, The Souvenir, Part Two. In English filmmaker Joanna Hogg's piercingly wistful semi-autobiographical film, a young student in 1980s London honors Swinton Byrne in a subtle, captivating performance, tries to make sense of a heartbreaking personal tragedy as she completes her graduate film. With that seemingly simple story, Hogg captures a thousand facets of what it is like to be a young person, eager to make a mark on the world, while also needing desperately to make sense of it all. Parallel Mothers, number five. Penelope Cruz gives a smashing performance as a Madrid woman who becomes a mother in middle age, even as she is striving to win justice for her great-grandfather, murdered during the Spanish Civil War, his body tossed into a mass grave. Director Pedro Almodovar uses melodrama to reckon with the painful history of his country, but also to reaffirm an essential truth about motherhood. History is the work of mothers. Civilization cannot move on without them. Number six, Passing. In this beautifully rendered adaptation of Nella Larsen's compact, potent 1929 novel, Two Girlhood Friends, played superbly by Tessa Thompson and Ruth Neja, reconnect as adults, their lives not just intersecting but colliding. Both women are black, but one has chosen to live as white. First-time director Rebecca Hall gives us a deeply thoughtful spin on what we commonly call the American dream, the ability to make something of ourselves or to remake ourselves as we wish, a so-called freedom that comes sometimes at perilous cost. Number 7, The Disciple. A singer with great drive and discipline, played with searching openness by Aditya Modak, strives to make a life for himself in the rarefied and decidedly unlucrative world of Indian classical music, only to be forced to recognize he's missing the essential spark of genius. Director Chaitanya Tamhani's luminous, quietly affecting film examines what it means to pursue a dream of art so feverishly that living in the real world takes a back seat. 8. Come On, Come On. Joaquin Phoenix gives a funny, finely wrought performance as a childless New York City radio journalist who takes charge of his precocious 9-year-old Los Angeles nephew, Woody Norman, for a few weeks. How does that even sound like a whole movie? But in the hands of writer-director Mike Mills, it is everything. No one's better at chronicling late 20th and early 21st century family affection in all its thorny, shimmery beauty. The Tragedy of Macbeth is 9. You may have seen this material 100 times before. But Joel Cohen's shivery black and white rendering. Starring Frances McDormand and Denzel Washington as the treacherous, scheming Scots, compelling as a demon spell, pulls off that rare feat. It puts you in the shoes of the play's first audience, as if this 400-year-old play were unfolding anew. Now, as then, it chills to the bone. Finally, number 10, Drive My Car. In Ryosuke Hamaguchi's swimmingly gorgeous 3-hour drama, adapted from a Haruki Murakami short story, a widowed actor and theater director from Tokyo, Hidetoshi Nishijima, accepts a gig in Hiroshima, mounting a production of Chekhov's Uncle Vanya. A young woman from the country, Toko Miura, has been hired to drive him. Their slow-building friendship helps illuminate how lost he really is. Hamaguchi weaves a lustrous story of loss and forgiveness, a gentle nudge of encouragement suggesting that no matter how tired you feel, you can move on in the world. Another of Time's 2021 Best of Culture is The Best TV Shows by Judy Berman. It also includes 10 short reviews. I'll try to read one or two of these to you. I'm just choosing them arbitrarily. Number 5 is Reservation Dogs. Creator Sterling Harjo, H-A-R-J-O, and Taika Waititi have given TV something it desperately needed, a great show by and about indigenous people. Set on an Oklahoma reservation, this dramedy follows 4 teens mourning a friend as they scam and save to honor his dream of moving to California. Like many recent shows, Atlanta, Betty, it has a hazy, surreal meets DIY vibe, moving fluidly between hijinks, gallows humor, and earnest emotion. Add stars who disappear into their roles and writers' refusal to dilute indigenous culture or anger for non-native audiences, and the result is as uncompromising as it is groundbreaking. Number 8 is We Are Lady Parts! Exclamation point. In this UK import, a timid microbiology PhD student, Anjana Vasan, strays from the path to achievement, arranged marriage, and perfect womanhood when her killer guitar chops get her recruited by an all-Muslim girl punk band. A subversive, hilarious, and dare I say it, empowering comedy. Lady Parts shatter stereotypes just by authentically inhabiting its characters. Each young woman is a whole person, and one we've never seen on TV before. 10. You. It is an enticing premise. A cute, bookish romantic turns out to be a psycho killer. But by the end of season one, this insanely popular rom-com satire had made its point about the genre's hidden creepiness. Happily, the show has found new targets. This year's third and best season sent Penn Badgley's murderous Joe and his unhinged bride to a ritzy California town to raise their baby, taking on everything from momfluencers to swingers in a searing send-up of pop culture's obsession with suburbia. The best TV shows, according to Time, included The Underground Railroad, The White Lotus, Work in Progress, Exterminate the Brutes, Reservation Dogs, Yellow Jackets, Succession. We Are Lady Parts. I think you should leave. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com. That is gsuggsinsurance.com. Or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.